one of the things that's pretty easy to say about the sexual revolution is that the ideas that were put forth when it began were considered radical. Everyone, even the willing participants in the sexual revolution, considered these ideas and these concepts radical. Many joined the sexual revolution because they liked that kind of a radical move. Well, nowadays, they are passé. Even the most radical ideas of the sexual revolution, when it began, are now considered mainstream. And fewer people look upon the aftermath of the sexual revolution. I guess we shouldn't say aftermath, really the continuation of the sexual revolution, with any real shock. But if you actually examine those ideas and what has come of them in our culture, in our families, in our lives, you will be shocked. We're going to talk about consumer sex and the state of the sexual revolution during this hour of Issues Etc. with Jennifer Roback Morse. I'm Todd Wilkin. Thanks for tuning us in. Now, you can join the conversation. Our in-studio email address is issuesetc@kfuo.org, issuesetc@kfuo.org, or you can give us a call, 1-800-730-2727, 1-800-730-2727. Jennifer Roback Morse is a research fellow at the Hoover Institute and author of the new book, Smart Sex, Finding Lifelong Love in a Hookup World. Jennifer, welcome back.
Hey, I'm glad to be on the program.
Jennifer, what did the sexual revolution promise, and what did it deliver?
Todd, it promised freedom, it promised happiness, it promised no unwanted children, no abused children, and instead what it gave us has been misery and unhappiness and just as many unwanted children as ever before, and certainly more, just as many abused children, just as many as unhappy children. And it certainly did not bring about equality for women.
Do you agree with me, Jennifer, that the ideas of the sexual revolution, once considered radical, even by the willing participants in the thing, are now mostly mainstream?
Yeah, we've become very jaded about sex. You know, people take for granted certain things today that were shocking and radical when they were first proposed. So it's been like a steamroller through the society, changing people's views of themselves and what is acceptable behavior to the point where what was considered unusual or unacceptable 10 years ago is now mainstream.
Is there any aspect of, in America, let's keep it there, of human discourse and intercourse, both literally and figuratively, political, social, ecclesiastical, familial, grassroots, big picture, any aspect of our society that has been untouched and untainted by the sexual revolution?
Well, it's hard to think of one, maybe banking or something. I don't know, maybe the Federal Reserve hasn't changed too much from it. But no, it really has had, the import of your question, of course, is that it has had widespread, far-reaching ramifications, and that's perfectly true. I mean, this is summertime. And one of the things you see today that you wouldn't have seen 30 years ago is today you can see children traveling on airplanes by themselves. And why are children traveling on airplanes by themselves? What is an unaccompanied minor that every airline has a policy to deal with, an unaccompanied minor? Well, mostly it's a child going between divorced parents, flying to visit one relative or another, one parent or another. And it's very small children often, and it isn't unusual to see children crying at the airport because they don't want to leave the parent they're leaving, even if they love the parent they're going to. And that, you know, those kids on the planes by themselves, either in tears or with this kind of hard-edged, closed-off, walled-off look to them, those kids are part of the fallout of the whole revolution in sexual behavior.
Jennifer, you have an insight in this book that is for me, really opened a window into understanding the sexual revolution and kind of its latest manifestation, the whole movement for reproductive freedom. You say that reproductive freedom is really about fear. What do you mean?
Well, I think people are afraid of the responsibility and the commitment of having a child, for one. And people are afraid of the responsibility and commitment to the child's other parent. And I think that the idea that you can have, what reproductive freedom in fact means, I don't know, I say that in here somewhere in the book. what it really means, Todd, when the people are fighting on the Supreme Court about, you know, we want our reproductive rights protected, what they're really talking about is the right to unlimited sexual activity without a live baby resulting. I mean, that's really what it is. It's the ability to have sex without a live baby coming of it. And when you think about it that way, it's not nearly so appealing as, quote, reproductive self-determination. You know, you can avoid having a child by not having sex. That's not what people are after. What people are after is the ability to have sex without having a child, unless you really exactly want the child at that particular moment.
So it's not just a fear of the child. I mean, it's not just the birth that is feared here, but the responsibility and the relationship that would come from, golly, someone fathered this child.
Right.
Maybe he might be my husband.
Right.
This child's going to stick around for a long time. I might have to develop a relationship with the little guy.
See, this is one of the fallacies of the sexual revolution. See, the idea was that you could have casual sex. I mean, one of the things that I argue in the book is that casual sex, in a sense, is not really possible because our bodies tend to attach themselves and connect themselves to the people that we have sex with. Now, if you have a baby, you might think you can become a single mom, and some people do think they can become a single mom and not have anything to do with the child's father. But, you know, it isn't unusual for you to end up having relationships and entanglements with that other person far beyond what you might have expected. I mean, the idea that you're going to be off there all by yourself doing it alone and never have to deal with the guy, you know, that is often not very realistic. You know, he can present himself and make demands of his own and make demands for being a part of the child's life and so on. And so the idea that you can have sex without being really connected to the other person, to your sex partner, that's really a myth, you know, because if a baby happens, you're both going to be involved in that baby. And if the woman decides to have an abortion, it creates the idea or the illusion that the whole connection is severed between the two people. Well, it might be severed between the man and the woman, but there continue to be repercussions often for the woman from having the abortion. So that what we're really seeking, you know, when a woman presents herself to have an abortion, what she's really asking for is, make my life the way it was before I got pregnant. Take all of this away and make it all go back to the way it was. And that's not realistic. I mean, you're not going to go back to the way you were before, you know. And the fact is that when we're having sex with somebody that we haven't given too much thought to, we are setting ourselves up for a whole series of possible connections and entanglements that might not go anything like the way we hoped or wanted.
You know, struggling with this because just a day or two ago I was finishing up a long overdue piece on the false promises of abortion. I was writing it more from a theological perspective, Jennifer. But I came to a sentence that I had written that said something like, abortion, the ultimate promise of abortion was sex without consequences. And I was uncomfortable with that term, consequences, because I didn't want to say, well, the baby is a consequence, or the relationship that may develop is a consequence. Maybe better, sex without any relationships.
Mm-hmm.
Is that a good way to put it?
Well, you know, it is, except I wouldn't shy away from that term consequences, Todd, because the natural organic purpose of human sexuality is to create relationships. I mean, that's what our human sexuality is about. I think that's a biblical perspective as well as a biological perspective. I mean, I think science is on the side of Scripture here, because the science obviously tells us that having sex produces babies, at least in a probabilistic sense, right? Not every act of sex produces a baby, but, you know, there's always a chance that if you have sex, you're going to have a baby. And science is also telling us about how our hormones work, such that we now know that women do attach themselves to their sex partners. And I think, you know, the evolutionary biologists will tell you, well, gosh, this makes perfect sense. It's a great survival strategy to attach yourself to the man who may be the father of your child and whose help you're going to need to raise that child. Likewise, men connect themselves to their sex partners because they feel some possessiveness towards their children and towards the mother of their children. So even though we have this image of men sowing their wild oats and, you know, having lots of sex partners and so on and so forth, you know, even the sheikh with his 25 wives is not going to feel okay about her messing around with some other guy. I mean, he still feels some connection towards her, which I would argue might border on the pathological possessiveness. But nevertheless, the idea that having sex is a matter that we should be indifferent about or that has no relationship consequence to it, hey, that's just not, that's not good science. That's not good biology. The biology tells you that sex is there to build up the relationship between the couple and to build up the family by bringing forth new members. And that's the part that the revolutionaries really wanted to avoid. You know, they wanted to be able to have sex without relationship. And that, as you have noted, is really a fraud. That's a fraudulent promise. And it's not good for us. Even if you could achieve that objective, it's really not good for us because it goes against our basic biological nature, which is to bring forth new life and to carry on the species.
You have also observed, Jennifer, that the sexual revolution brought us, with all its talk of freedom, really a new and very different definition of freedom. What is it?
Well, the new definition of freedom, I would say, and at least in the sexual and social area, is to be free is to be completely unencumbered by human relationships. See, that when you talk about reproductive freedom, sexual freedom, freedom of sexual expression, divorce freedom, all of these things center around being completely free and unencumbered by other people and your relationships to them. So it's not just about the sex act itself, like the Roe v. Wade type freedom, but also the freedom to divorce, you know, that the idea that a modern woman's freedom depends on her ability to walk away from her spouse at any time for any reason, or for no reason for that matter. That's a very peculiar notion of freedom, and one that says that human relationships are in opposition to freedom. And I don't think that's a very humane or sustainable view of what freedom is all about.
What is consumer sex?
Consumer sex is a word that I made up for sex that views the other person as an object. Todd, I think that the modern view of human sexuality is that sex is a private recreational good with no moral or social consequences. That's what we now think sex is. It's just a private recreational good. Well, when you view it that way, it really is kind of a consumer good. You do it for fun. And the problem with it is that the other person becomes an object or a consumer good, something that satisfies you more or less well. And if you are not satisfied with the consumer good, what do we do with it? We throw it away, or we get a new one, or we take it back to the store and cash it in. And that I think that is at the core of why the sexual revolution has been so painfully disappointing to people, because nobody wants to be on the receiving end of that. And yet, if once you accept the premises of the sexual revolution, you're basically playing by those rules. You know, you're basically saying, well, okay, this is all about fun, and I agree to be used by you as long as you let me use you. And in the end, that's not a very good bargain.
We're talking with Jennifer Roback Morse about consumer sex. She is author of the new book, Smart Sex, Finding Lifelong Love in a Hookup World. You can find out more about the book, Smart Sex, at Spence Publishing. Their website, www.spencepublishing.com. That's spencepublishing.com, or you can call them toll-free, 1-888-SPENPUB, 1-888-SPENPUB. That's Spence Publishing. Kathy calls us, and welcome to Issues Etc., Kathy.
Thank you for taking my call. I've always wondered, when I hear the word revolution, I also think of, you know, revolutions, governmental overthrows of the past. And this was an overthrow of an understanding of sex that had been with us, the human race, through, you know, at least 2, 3, 4, 5,000 years. I guess, can we compare numbers of death tolls? I know, you know, when we talk about the, you know, the revolution of the, in the, that happened in the, in Russia and this, and then the Soviet Union came from that. We talk about death, you know, tolls. I think it would be interesting to know the death tolls from this sexual revolution compared to other revolutions. You know, with AIDS and abortion and sexually transmitted diseases and a whole host of other things that could come from this type of revolution. Has anyone ever addressed that?
Kathy, thank you very much. That's a question right up Jennifer's alley. Jennifer.
Boy, that is a great question, and I wish I had a good answer for it. That's an excellent question. I like the way she put it, that the sexual revolution has claimed many lives, if you count up the people who have been aborted, the people who have been who have died prematurely from sexually transmitted diseases, including AIDS. The other kind of cost that we might add into that, though, is besides those sort of life and death kinds of costs, people dying, is the people dying prematurely because of loneliness, because of broken marriages, because of inability to form marriages. We now know, for instance, that marriage increases people's longevity. You know, so and getting divorced is like taking on a smoking habit, is what some authors will tell you. You know, if you look at the statistics, the increase in the probability of death is something like what it would be if you started smoking. So you know, there are many, many ramifications of the change in sexual attitudes, and I think it would be interesting to tally those up. And I don't know anyone who's done that.
You have written, kind of coming back around on the occasion of Kathy's question, to the comprehensive nature of the effects of the sexual revolution. You say the future of freedom depends on people with a conscience. People with consciences don't emerge out of thin air, but are created inside of a loving family, and families are created by love and marriage. Have those been the two biggest casualties of the sexual revolution? Love and marriage, ergo families, ergo then even people with consciences?
Well, I think that the short answer is yes. Yes, I think to me the two big pieces of the sexual revolution are, one, Roe versus Wade, the unlimited abortion license, and I think people need to understand how radical Roe versus Wade really is. That it prohibits any kind of regulation of abortion by any state, and it permits basically abortion on demand all the way up until birth and almost after, as we know from our debates over partial birth abortion and so on. So that was one of the very most radical planks of the sexual revolution. The other one, for my money, the most radical piece, has been the change in divorce laws that took place on a state-by-state basis. This is something we can't blame on the Supreme Court. It's something that took place on a state-by-state basis, where state after state basically abolished fault as a consideration in divorce, and basically instituted what is usually called no-fault divorce, but what I call, what I think is more accurate to call it, unilateral divorce, meaning that one party can end the marriage unilaterally for any reason, for no reason, against the wishes of the other person. And again, that's something many people don't really fully understand. People have the idea that no-fault divorce just meant that if two people agreed they were going to get a divorce, the state wouldn't mess around with them. The state would just let them have that divorce at lowest cost as possible. But in point of fact, how it's unfolded, how it's developed, is that the person who wants to end the marriage has the law standing behind them, more or less. The person who wants to keep on working on the marriage, who wants to continue trying to keep the marriage alive, that person doesn't have any legal ground to stand on to keep the other person at it, to keep them trying, or to even impose any kind of penalties on them for walking away. So if you think about it as a contract, which I think is a very crude way to think of marriage, and it's much more than a contract, but if you just think about marriage as a contract, we basically have a system of contract law that allows people to violate their contracts with no penalty and for no reason. And it's hard to imagine any other area of life where we would accept a thing like that. I mean, the real estate market would collapse completely if people could walk away from their real estate contracts or from their construction contracts. You couldn't get anything done that is important, that takes long periods of time. You have to have contracts. And what is it that marriage produces that's important? It produces children. It produces well-adjusted adult people out of these little blobs that are called children, you know, that these little masses of emotions and whiny and snotty noses and wet bottoms and all of that. Marriage takes those little beings and turns them into adults who can function in society. That's a long-term job, if ever there was one, And somehow we expect people to do that with no contractual protection whatsoever. It's really crazy. You wouldn't expect any other, you know, and we're getting the kind of results that you might expect. People are investing in one or two kids that they think they can manage on their own. If all, you know, if the whole thing should collapse, then at least they know they can manage those very few children on their own. And they're making kind of arm's length investments in their kids. You know, people are hiring out a lot of the effort that goes into taking care of kids. So there's a kind of phenomenon among kids, and this is something that, you know, we could argue about. Not everybody would agree with this. I can't document this, but I think you'll recognize this child when I mention this child. There are many children in our society who are simultaneously overindulged and neglected, undersupervised, but overindulged. And I think most people know the kind of kid I'm talking about. I think part of why that has happened is that adults have distanced themselves from this project, of this lifelong project of child rearing. They want it. We all want it. We want to have kids. We want them to have them turn out right. But at the same time, we're vulnerable in that enterprise uniquely, in a way that we're not vulnerable in any other thing that we try to do over a long period of time. There's nothing like that. And that is why I think that the divorce revolution has been just as big of and just as ugly a factor in breaking down the family and breaking down sexual mores. That divorce piece has been absolutely crucial.
We're talking with Jennifer Roback Morris about consumer sex. Our call-in number, 1-800-730-2727, 1-800-730-2727, and our in-studio email address is issuesetc@kfuo.org. Jennifer Roback Morris is a research fellow at the Hoover Institute. She is author of the new book called Smart Sex, Finding Lifelong Love in a Hookup World. When we come back from this break, we're going to talk about the whole notion of privacy. What became of privacy, and how is it that marriage and sex became not just private, but a radically private endeavor to the degree to which we don't feel like we can even touch upon it? In fact, how did we get to the hookup generation, where the whole point, according to the new social quote-unquote contract, especially among our young people and increasingly among people who are far more mature, the whole goal is to have not just casual sex, but in some cases, verging on anonymous sex. Where did it all begin, and where is it all going? We're going to answer those questions with Jennifer Roback Morse when we come back from this break. 1-800-730-2727 or issuesetc@kfuo.org. 1-800-730-2727.
The radio voice of the Lutheran faith for the 21st century. You're listening to Issues, Etc.
In the postmodern marketplace of ideas, Christians today must constantly distinguish between the God of Christianity, Father, Son, and Holy Spirit, and the generic God of American civil religion. Is this confrontation between Christianity and civil religion a new problem for Christians? How did American civil religion change in the last 50 years to become less like Christianity and more like Buddhism? Find answers to these questions and more in our Issues Etc. Book of the Month for August, The Anonymous God, The Church Confronts Civil Religion and American Society. This book is edited by two Issues Etc. regular guests, Dr. David Adams and Dr. Ken Sherb. For more information about The Anonymous God, go to our website, issuesetc.org, or call Concordia Publishing House, 1-800-325-3040, 1-800-325-3040.
Humanists say the church is not a threat. Answers with Ken Ham, whose ministry is building a large creation museum near Cincinnati, Ohio. Well, Ken, do humanists really say the church isn't a threat to their beliefs?
Well, let me give you an example in regards to our future creation museum. Our ministry applied to county authorities to have a piece of land near Cincinnati rezoned. We wanted to build a museum that teaches the truth about Genesis and proclaim the gospel. Well, the community was astonished to see the way in which the local humanist group tried to influence the county to stop the project from proceeding. At one of the meetings where many opponents met to try to stop our project, a humanist made this statement. We wouldn't mind so much if they wanted to build a church, but they want to build a creation museum to change our minds. Now that tells you something about the reputation some people have about the church. You see, because much of the church has compromised with evolution, many church leaders don't attack the evolutionary foundation of the humanist philosophy. Humanists don't see the church as a threat to the anti-God religion. But our museum will directly attack the foundation of humanism by exposing the problems with evolution and teaching the truth about creation. That's why our ministry is seen as such a threat.
Our future museum will not only deal with the problems with evolution, but also answer some of the most asked questions about the Bible, such as, where did Cain find his wife? Well, you don't have to wait for the museum to open. You can read Ken Ham's booklet on Cain's wife when you go to answersradio.com.
This is Dr. John Tape with the Media Minute. How many ads do you think our children see on the internet, billboards, and TV? According to clinical psychologist Dr. Mary Pfeiffer, when it's all put together, our children see over 400 ads every day. She writes, quote, 400 ads a day create in children a combination of entitlement and dissatisfaction, end quote. Teach your children that contrary to what these ads would have us believe, the Bible teaches us that we are entitled to nothing except God's wrath and punishment because of our sin. Yet we never need to be dissatisfied because in spite of our sin, God still loves us for Jesus' sake and He provides for all our needs. We deserve nothing, but in Christ we receive everything. This Media Minute is brought to you by the Christian Media Literacy Institute. Please visit our website at cmli.org.
We're going to try something new. We're taking our Bible study program on the road, and you can watch the broadcast. On Wednesday, August 10th, we'll originate our regular Bible study program from Peace Lutheran Church in South St. Louis County. Pastor Ken Wagoner will be the guest. Why don't you come to our live broadcast and bring a friend? Lunch will be served afterwards. I hope to see you Wednesday, August 10th, 10:05 in the morning for our live Bible study program from Peace Lutheran Church in South St. Louis County.
Welcome back to Issues Etc. I'm Todd Wilkin. We're talking about consumer sex and the current state of the sexual revolution. Our guest is Dr. Jennifer Roback Morse. Now, she has a great website you need to visit tonight when you go home. It's called jointhemarriagerevolution.com. Jointhemarriagerevolution.com. It's all just one big word. Jointhemarriagerevolution.com, the website for Dr. Jennifer Roback Morse. Our guest, our call-in number, 1-800-730-2727, and our in-studio email address is issuesetc@kfuo.org. Jennifer, what has become of the notion of privacy, which has become one of the watchwords for the sexual revolution? I don't even know if the revolution could articulate much of what it has to say, past and present, if it were not for this word, privacy.
Well, you know, it's funny you ask that, because that word has really taken a beating and it's been hauled out into service into service of all sorts of things, and the most famous one, of course, is the right to privacy, which is supposed to be the foundation for Roe versus Wade for that whole line of argument. But there's so many things we could say about that argument that is misleading. I mean, first of all, the foundation argument for the contraception case in Griswold versus Connecticut. Most people don't know this, but the first case, Griswold versus Connecticut, struck down Connecticut statutes regulating contraception, and the reason that they did it was because they found a right of marital privacy. Griswold versus Connecticut did not find a right to use contraception; it found a right to marital privacy, and said that if we tried to prevent married couples from using contraception, we would have to invade marital privacy in a way that would be destructive to marriage and that we shouldn't do and we don't want to do. And so with that argument in place, it made it possible for freestanding birth control clinics to be set up, Planned Parenthood kind of centers to be set up, rather than people getting their contraception from their doctor in private, you might say, in a more private way, obtaining the use of contraceptions. You could go to a freestanding clinic and get your stuff from Planned Parenthood. And this was the thing that really allowed Planned Parenthood to take off. Now, the next case after that was Eisenstadt versus Baird in 1972, which argued that right to privacy that allowed a married couple to use contraception should be extended to individuals, that if a married couple had the same right, then the individual should have the right. And it doesn't really quite follow, but that is what they found. And what was interesting about that case is that this is where the court defined the right to reproductive freedom in the sense that they said the right to decide whether to beget or bear a child is so private that the state shouldn't have anything to do with it. Well, now that's, you can say, well, gee, that makes sense. The state shouldn't be bothering people about whether to beget or bear a child. But the problem is that they made it sound like begetting and bearing a child was something that you were entitled to have perfect control over, and that the state was, in fact, in a position to guarantee. And, of course, the state isn't in a position to guarantee the outcome of a decision, and normally we don't think about freedom as being the state guaranteeing us something. Normally we think about the state setting ground rules, you making choices, and then living with the outcome. But in this case, the state took on to itself the claim that you were, as an individual, entitled to get the outcome you wanted from your reproductive choices. And so it's not surprising that 1 year later, less than a year later, the court came out with Roe versus Wade, which says you are entitled basically to have sex without having a live baby result, because that's what they were really talking about in Eisenstadt in the first place, but they just hadn't come quite out and said that. But the idea that you're entitled to control the outcome of your reproductive behavior is really quite different from any other sort of freedom that we have, Todd. It's almost like saying that economic freedom means you're entitled to have the job you want at the pay you want, no matter how you work, no matter what your work performance is. You know, it's not an entitlement to participation right or to a process right. It's an entitlement to a specific outcome, which in fact the state never tries to guarantee ordinarily, and it's just the peculiarity of this kind of area of reproductive freedom, so-called, and the language that's being used that's allowing this right to unlimited sexual activity. This is the cover that is being presented to cover up for this thing, which is really not very appealing when you see it bald and naked like that, that what we're asking for is the constitutional protection to do any sex we want without a baby coming. That's not so appealing, but reproductive self-determination sounds very American and very, freedom-oriented and so on. And but people need to see, I think, that this is really quite a different kind of freedom.
Well, I can see. I want to come back to something you just said in passing there. The leap from the court granting married couples or recognizing that some sort of right of privacy attaches to married couples when it comes to reproduction. And then what you said was a leap, and what certainly appears like a leap to me, saying that right to privacy also attaches to individuals.
Right.
It seems as though the court is conceding there to a great degree that marriage and reproduction in law really have no real connection to one another.
That sequence of cases really did a tremendous damage to the concept of marriage as a conjugal unit, what we would call the conjugal vision of what marriage is, that marriage is an institution that connects sexual activity, reproduction, and the care of children, that it's a unique human institution that has those functions, that is necessarily a gender-based institution, that is necessarily has something to do with children, reproduction, and making sure that all kids have two parents, that those functions of marriage, those cases, as I've just described them, really did begin to kick the legs out from under the foundations of that particular view of marriage. I think there's no doubt about it. And I think people get nervous when you start talking about that, because for most people, contraception is such a done deal that nobody wants to go back and talk about contraception. And, you know, I don't want to talk about contraception in the sense that I don't think we should have statutes outlawing contraception. That isn't really the point here, and that's not the reason that I'm bringing this up. The point is that the arguments that were being used to defend these cases are really very weak and very tendentious kinds of arguments, and that once you carry them out to their logical extreme, as you just did, Todd, you can see that it's beginning to disrupt the ancient understanding of what marriage is supposed to be about.
But once you've made one big leap and are willing to live with it, then you're willing to take the next big leap, as you mentioned, at Roe.
That's right.
Where the court says, look, and correct me if I'm wrong, the way that they were thinking of privacy in Roe, which is, look, a woman, an individual woman, has the right to keep private from everyone, including the father of the child.
Yep.
The fact that she's pregnant, and if she has to kill the child to do it, to cover up the evidence, and I cannot think of a more gracious way of saying it, then she should have that right because privacy trumps all.
That's right. That's right. That is in fact what they're saying. And, you know, when you think about it in terms of the other line of rhetoric that people use is the right to choose. You see, that's the favorite kind of public argument about abortion. That's not so much Supreme Court jurisprudence. The privacy part is more on the Supreme Court side. But in the public relations side, defending abortion has always been in terms of women's right to choose. But if you think about the choice, that the choice is a very asymmetric kind of choice. It's a very unfair kind of choice because the choice to keep the baby and to raise the baby will necessarily involve lots of other people. I mean, if I have a baby and I want to place it for adoption, the father gets to have something to say about that. The father has to surrender parental rights. My mom might show up and have something to say about whether I put the baby up for adoption. My boyfriend's mom might show up. There are all kinds of people who might put their oar in the water about that particular decision. Whereas if I go to have an abortion, nobody gets to decide. You know, it's just me. I by myself get to make this judgment, and it's a judgment that protects me in a way from a lot of messy interactions and relationships with other people. And so if you think about that as a right to choose, it's a very peculiar sort of a choice that we're saying. You know, we're presenting these two very peculiar options to people, and where one is so much easier, it seems to be so much the easier way out for a person, so much less complicated way out. And we're saying, here, go ahead, you're free to choose whatever you want. Well, in effect, the state has its thumb on the scale and basically saying, we permit you to kill your unborn child without consulting the father, but we don't permit you to put the baby up for adoption without consulting the father. There's something a little bit unbalanced about that decision-making process, and that has been created by the state and its laws.
Wouldn't the logic of the whole privacy argument bear upon that, where if the court is going to be consistent, they would say, and I wouldn't want this to be the case, but they would say, hey, if you want to put the baby up for adoption, you should be able to do that
as
an equal option to killing
the thing. And you forego all but you see, the reason you can't really do that is because the truth of the matter is that having a baby is not a private act. It is not something that a woman does completely by herself, independently of others, and having no impact on others. This is not a consumer good kind of project that you're engaged in. If you have a baby, you're going to need the help of other people because it's really too much to raise a baby by yourself and earn a living. In fact, it can't be done. You're going to need some income. You're going to need somebody to watch your baby. You're going to need an employer. You're going to need all kinds of things, even if you don't marry. So you're not really doing it all alone. And the law, in effect, recognizes that, but when it demands that the father make some kind of child support payment, you know, when it insists that the father has some responsibility toward the woman and her child. Now, if you have a baby outside of marriage, then the state has to come into the picture and somehow help you to extract resources from the boy or the husband or the man, you know, the father. The state has to help you to do that. So even in that case where the woman is trying to do it all by herself, it doesn't really work out to be all by herself because the support of the father, she can't make that happen by herself. It's the threat of the law that makes him pony up the money. And the reason the law asks him to pony up is because it recognizes that he had some responsibility in bringing forth this new life, and is trying to put the responsibility for the child onto both of the child's natural parents. Well, you know what? The simple way to do that is what this other institution used to do routinely and automatically, and that was called marriage. You know, the institution of marriage is designed exactly to connect the father and the mother to each other and to the child without a whole lot of messing around by the family courts or the state or the police or the Child Protective Services and all the other people that end up being involved in trying to negotiate the problems between unmarried parents often.
For those who have been living under a rock for the last 10 or 15 years, would you explain what a hookup is and the scope of the problem?
Hooking up. Well, a hookup is a term that has developed on college campuses and in the single scene. And what it means is a sexual encounter where neither party has any hope or thought that the sex act is going to lead to a relationship. So it's a new name for what used to be called a one-night stand, and it's reasonably common on college campuses. There was a survey done a couple of years ago by the Institute for American Values, which showed that on most campuses this was a phenomenon that everybody recognized the phenomenon when you named it, and that probably a quarter of young women would admit to themselves to having hooked up, and some admitted to doing it, you know, a lot of times. So it's a pretty widespread phenomenon, and there are a lot of, you know, there's kind of a culture around it that supports it and tries to manage some of its worst effects, I suppose you could say. So it's widespread enough that everybody knows what you're talking about and what some of the problems are associated with it.
So, you know, someone's going to come off one of these encounters and say something, like you say in your book, we're just friends. But I'm wondering whether that's even stretching the definition of friend. If are friends the kind of people I have anonymous sex with and then forget about on purpose?
Well, you know, it doesn't have to be anonymous. It could just be, you know, some guy in your English lit class and, you know, you're sort of out together and you sort of go, well, that'd be sort of fun. And so you'd end up in each other's dorm, one of the people's dorm room, and you kind of do it and you get up the next morning and say, that's nice, goodbye, you know. So it doesn't have to be anonymous, although some people are into that. The thing that I really try to call attention to is that the hookup, people do it because they're afraid of the relationship or they're afraid of the commitment. But then once you've had the encounter, our bodies tend to connect us with our sex partners, whether we wanted to or not. And so it isn't unusual for a young woman in particular to wake up the next day and wonder whether the guy will call her again, and kind of hope that the guy will call her again, and kind of wonder what it meant to the other person and whether it meant as much to him as it meant to her, and to just wonder whether she's been used. And all of those thoughts and feelings are supposed to not bother us. You know, the rules of the sexual revolution are that you're not supposed to assign too much meaning to a casual sexual encounter. And I just want people to realize that in point of fact, we do attach meaning to our sexual encounters, that co-eds do sit by the phone wondering whether the kind of waiting for the guy to call. And it's pointless to say, oh, get over it. You know, you're making too big of a fuss about it. The fact is that we want our sexual encounters to have meaning. We want to have a connection with another person. And we're really kidding ourselves when we say we can go from one hookup to another without any ill effect. Our bodies and our hearts feel the consequences of what we're doing. And either we get a lot of hurt feelings about it, or we create kind of calluses over our hearts so that we don't feel too much. We kind of numb ourselves so that we don't feel too much about it, so that it doesn't hurt so badly. But either of those strategies that we do do not prepare us very well for marriage. Because in marriage, what we want to do is to give ourselves completely to the other person. We don't want to hold back. Holding back is the wrong time to be holding back. And yet the hookup culture really prepares us for holding back on our spouses in the future. And that, I think, accounts for some of the disappointing results of the casual sex culture.
We're talking with Dr. Jennifer Roback-Moore. She's a research fellow at the Hoover Institute and author of the new book, Smart Sex, Finding Lifelong Love in a Hookup World. You can purchase the book, Smart Sex, by calling Spence Publishing, 1-888-SPENPUB, 1-888-SPENPUB, or you can find them on the web at www.spencepublishing.com. Jennifer, I actually heard the other day, I don't know where this was, but, you know, in the old days, you used to hear that a couple was living together and then had decided to get married, and people would say, okay, well, at least they're going to get married if they're living together.
Right.
I actually heard the other day someone say they had heard about a couple sleeping together, and the person said, well, at least they're going to live together. And we kind of stepped back one. I think maybe 10 years from now we'll hear, well, at least they're sleeping together or something like that. I don't know where you go. It gets reduced down to nothing eventually. Talk about cohabitation. Someone says, look, cohabitation's got to be better for us than the hookup.
Well, you know, that's a property of minimums, as you say. It's better than in the better than nothing category. I wouldn't get too excited about something being better than a hookup. Yes, the thing people need to realize about cohabitation is how poor a preparation it really is for marriage, and what an inferior substitute it really is for marriage. I mean, a lot of times people think that, oh, it's just a piece of paper. Marriage is just a piece of paper, isn't going to make any difference. Well, as a matter of fact, it does make a difference. As a matter of fact, people who live together statistically look more like single people than like married people. So do their kids. I mean, if you have children, the cohabiting experience is definitely not good for kids. There's more domestic violence in cohabiting relationships. Children are more likely to be victimized by their parents, or more likely to be child abuse inside cohabiting relationships. So that for a number of reasons, they're really not the same experience at all. And the final frosting on the cake is that people who live together before marriage are less likely to have a successful marriage than people who do not. So you're more likely to get divorced if you live together beforehand rather than if you don't. So just for a whole lot of reasons, living together is not really a good substitute for marriage.
So the old adage, which is usually kind of the rationale among the people who actually take time to think about it. Well, okay, look, maybe I've come out of a bad marriage, or maybe I'm a little bit worried about marriage because I come from a broken home. The prudent thing to do is to give it a test drive,
right,
as you say.
Right.
That turns out to not work out that way.
Right, that's exactly right. The test drive idea just really doesn't work. In fact, I have an article called Why Not Take Her for a Test Drive? The reason, biologically, the reason it doesn't work is that, as I've said before, the body is connecting to the sex partner. So you have this idea that we're going to be rational about it, we're going to sit down and make a reasonable decision. After living together for a while, we'll know whether it's working or not, and we'll be able to be rational about it and so on. Well, what happens, in fact, is that the act of living together and sleeping together and touching each other builds a physiological connection. It creates what one author calls an involuntary chemical commitment. And so you get connected with the other person, and it's not so easy to break up, even if it's wrong, even if the relationship isn't going well, and even if it's not really a suitable person. It's much harder to break up than people really give credit for. And so, therefore, the fact that you went into it without thinking the whole thing through, you never really quite recover from that, you see, because you don't really have the chance to relieve yourself of the relationship if things aren't going the way they should be. And the other thing that happens is that the cohabiting experience means something different to men than to women. Women tend to view living together as a step, a progressive step towards marriage. You know, like, okay, I got the guy to move in with me now. You know, maybe in a year or two, maybe we'll get married. You know, but guys, on the other hand, view cohabitation as a perfectly acceptable end state. You know, they don't necessarily need to get married or feel any big urge to get married. And I'm speaking on averages now. Okay, this is generalization, obviously. Well, what that does is it puts into motion some dynamics in the relationship that are hard to recover from after marriage. So the woman, for instance, will say, well, maybe I ought to bring it up today. Maybe today's the day I should try to extract a commitment from him, and maybe today I should try to talk to him about getting engaged, and so on and so forth. And but then again, maybe today isn't the day. Maybe he's in a bad mood. And so you sort of suppress that.
We've got about 20 seconds.
Sweep that under the rug, and you develop a habit of not speaking your mind because you don't want to rock the boat.
Here's our mailing address. It's Box 9360, St. Louis, Missouri, 63117. Here's our resource line number. It's 1-800-737-0172. Use either of those to receive a free complimentary copy of our Next Issues, Etc. journal, or to help support the Talk Radio for the Thinking Christian Issues, Etc. by making a tax-deductible gift. The address, Box 9360, St. Louis, Missouri, 63117. Or our resource line number, 1-800-737-0172. Jennifer Roback Morris is research fellow for the Hoover Institute and author of the new book, Smart Sex, Finding Lifelong Love in a Hookup World. Her website address, jointhemarriagerevolution.com. Jointhemarriagerevolution.com. Jennifer, thanks for being our guest.
Thank you, Todd.
It is so difficult to turn back the clock on something like this. But it begins precisely where Jennifer has pointed us again and again in this last hour. You know, we could try and go at it by eliminating the laws and the various institutions that have grown up to support the faulty structure of the sexual revolution. And we might make some progress there, and we should work for that, certainly. Overturn Roe v. Wade, yeah. Make our legislators rethink no-fault divorce, yes. Try and turn back the tide on the ever-creeping and changing definition of marriage in law? Yes. That is a noble effort. But the harder effort, really it is harder and probably in the long run, certainly the more effective effort, begins with you and your spouse and your kids. Your family. That's where it begins again. You know, that's where it's going to begin, even if you could overturn Roe and change the divorce laws and all of those other things. Those children that are in your care, that are growing to maturity, and yes, even sexual maturity in your care, who are shaped as much by mom and dad as by anything else, and especially the relationship between mom and dad, a sound, stable marriage for your kids, the best, absolutely the best thing you could provide for them. And through them for your grandkids, and through that for the entire society. I'm Todd Wilkin. Thanks for listening to Issues Etc.
Listen weekday afternoons to Issues Etc. Issues Etc. is a listener-supported program. Your financial support is critical for the continuation and expansion of this worldwide outreach. Our address is 85 Founders Lane, St. Louis, Missouri, 63105. You can donate by credit card on our resource line, 1-800-737-0172, 1-800-737-0172. For a free audio copy of this hour of Issues Etc., please visit the audio archive section at KFUO.org. Opinions expressed are not necessarily those of AM850 KFUO. Issues Etc. is a broadcast service of the Lutheran Church, Missouri Synod.